So I'm still at the Fort Wayne Symposium. I don't know when this is actually going to be released, how far down the road this will be coming out. But you might remember I was at this big event and had the opportunity to interview a bunch of guys. And someone I was really interested in talking to is an old friend of mine. His name is Timothy Winterstein. And he is the pastor at Faith Lutheran Church in East Wenatchee, Washington. You can find him online. He does produce some stuff. He has a podcast that's quite a few years in the making. He says it's irregular now. I don't know how regular it used to be. It's called Boars in the Vineyard. And it's him and another Lutheran pastor talking about theology.
Louis Polzine in Wisconsin.
What's Boars in the Vineyard? Why would you call a theology podcast Boars in the Vineyard?
It has to do with the Pope accusing Luther of being a boar rampaging through the vineyard. It comes from a psalm.
Yeah.
Which I can't remember off the top of my head.
So you're embracing the lambasting personality of Luther and just going ahead and running roughshod.
Yeah, I don't know how lambasty we are.
But that connects a little bit then, though, to this idea of the Jagged Word, which is a blog that you also write for.
Yeah, a number of people, I don't know, there's probably 10 or so writers, different topics. Some are weekly, some are otherwise. Almost every week I write something on Fridays about movies. I'm a programmer for the Newport Beach Film Festival, so I watch a lot of movies and then write about some of them that strike me.
What's the best movie you've seen recently?
There's one called Happy as Lazaro. It's Italian. Subtitles on Netflix, produced by Martin Scorsese.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's a unique movie. So Happy as Lazaro.
Unique. That's a vanilla way to describe a movie.
Because I watch a lot of movies, it's hard for me to be surprised sometimes by movies, and I was surprised. Halfway through this movie, it takes a complete turn that I was not expecting. I didn't know anything about it going in. Somebody recommended it, so I just watched it I like to not have expectations. So,
have you watched The Ballad of Buster Scruggs?
Yeah.
Were you surprised at all by that? I mean, just the opening vignette. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What? And it's not. That's not the whole movie. It's a vignette. What? Like, that threw me off big time.
It had its moments.
Yeah.
It wasn't as much Coen-y brother. I thought I was expecting maybe a little bit more, but as far as there's some philosophical type things going on in there, but yeah, it was good.
So we're going a totally different direction already, but so why should Christians think about the movies they watch?
It's good. Good question. Cause I don't know about anybody else, but for me, I go back and forth. Like, I can watch a movie that's pure entertainment just to sort of relax. Like,
sure.
Something I don't have to think about, I can just watch that. But other times, I want a movie that's going to make me think in some way. And the other thing, actually, probably my main answer to that question would be, movies are, the people who make the movies are coming from certain perspectives. And I think like anything else, like a novel, or anything like that, you're going to have people telling a story, and I'm convinced that it's going to highlight one aspect or another of the story. It's either going to highlight sin or redemption, or both. And when it interests me, when if someone I suspect is probably not a Christian, but they can make a movie that gets at some aspect of that story in a way that might get through to someone who's not a Christian. Like, I think my favorite example of that is Train to Busan, Korean zombie movie.
Oh, really? Yeah, and, never heard of it.
And it's not really about zombies. That's just the way to get at the story about this father and husband, and he's totally selfish at the beginning. It's literally about this guy as a father and whether he's a good father or not. And by the end of the movie, he's changed. Zombies is the mechanism they get there, but it's really about what it means to be a father and a husband. And to me, I don't have any idea whether the person who made it is a Christian, but to be able to get at that aspect of something in a way that's going to that could impact people who are not normally going to think about fatherhood, right? Or what it means to be a man or husband.
Right.
That's interesting to me.
That gets to first article things. My recent big thing in my own head is rediscovering the love of the first article. I think it's the answer to the three degrees of the law debates. We shouldn't be debating the use of the law. We should be loving the world we were created to exist in and pursuing it. And it stuns me that pagans who I listen to, who are reading the Stoics or who are just into Buddhism, like, they're better at talking about fatherhood than Christians are. And they have this, it's not like they're wrong. I mean, they've got something about the law that they've really embraced and how to discover it. And to see that in movie, I think that's pretty key too. But why is it that we aren't any good at, maybe we should ask the question this way, why do Christians make crappy movies?
Yeah, I've asked the question a number of times. I've talked to some other people about it. There's a guy named Thomas Torrey. We had him on Boars in the Vineyard, I don't know, a couple years ago, talking about a movie called Fair, F-A-R-E. And he basically takes a theme of the Screwtape Letters, but it's not made as, you know, it's not a Christian movie, right? There's, you know, there are enough vulgarities that it's rated R, right?
Right.
But so it's not a Christian movie, but a Christian made the movie to focus on what it means to be married and what it means to be, what kind of sacrifices you have to make. And so there are Christians who are making good movies, but when I think it's propaganda, I think that's the problem. And when you make something so that it's not coming organically from your point of view, it's you're trying to make a point or to say something. When you do that, the art is secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why. And it happens not only with Christian movies, it happens with crappy left-wing or right-wing movies too, politically or, mm-hmm. or secular, where they're trying to make a point about something. So they, you know, it's like Leni Riefenstahl or something, where you're trying to do propaganda for a cause rather than make a movie.
Most people don't know who Leni Riefenstahl is. I do.
Hitler's kind of... she made movies, like propaganda movies for Hitler. Mm-hmm. And
all the old footage you see of the troops doing all this, the troops marching in order and these big rallies that she was behind the filming of.
Triumph of the Will, isn't that her?
A documentary about her, right?
No. I think she made that about... Anyway.
There's a documentary about her that's really good.
Anyway, I think the problem is propaganda. When you're trying to make a point, say something, rather than do something well. I don't know. That's my thought.
No, I like it. I jotted down here the distinction between propaganda and art. I think that's a really cool topic. What I want to pick your brain about, kind of left turning here a little bit, is something that is personal for you. We don't have to go into the personal of it. It's personal for me too. I've been through versions of this. But division and deception within Christian congregations. And coming at that from a perspective of a pastor who has seen division and deception focused on you as the cause, when we know, biblically speaking, I mean, there are pastors who are the problem, but biblically speaking, the vast majority of division in the congregation is not caused by the pastor, it's caused by hatred of the Word of God. Now, we don't have to say that's your case or what have you, but I don't want to throw, for the listener who doesn't know you, like somehow you're under the bus. But I'm curious to talk about this just as a concept and if possibly to move also from congregation to synod, so the idea of walking together. I also would like to, from that, touch on managing your personal faith while under spiritual attack, and then maybe do a little bit about personal habits and tools by the end. It's a little more bland. But let's just start with division and deception. Share what you will about your experience with those things.
Well, I mean, it's a little hard to say specifically, but I think that there are probably a number of things that happen in congregations. One is simply a kind of a historical thing in the United States about what it means to be a Lutheran Christian, that you have, and the other thing is people's memories are very short, right? And so then my experience of 40 or 50 years or whatever it is determines my entire view of what it means to be either Christian or Lutheran or a member of a congregation or whatever. So anything that seems to challenge that, or what I learned from maybe my favorite pastor or my father who was a pastor or whoever, anything that sounds like it's challenging that, it becomes a threat to, probably a personal threat to my faith. I think that's probably how it's experienced. And so I think that's one thing. And then the other part of that probably is that people get, you know, we all have kind of ways of doing things, and we all have preferences and, experiences, but when those, when my preferences become the thing, because who is it that's ever been in church and be like, yep, every single thing here, it's exactly the way I want it. No, I don't think there's a single pastor or a single parishioner who's ever said everything in this place is exactly what I want it to be like. If they have, there might be other problems, but, you know, so I think it's when that sort of comes to rule how I see things, and there's no, and then for some reason there's a loss of grace toward other Christians, and sort of a you know, I know how things are supposed to be done, and therefore, and then sometimes that gets projected on the pastor. The pastor can't do that either, right? I know how. Look, here, let me tell you. But it's a, you know, there's the other thing is that in the church, we're very good at using pious language to justify our actions. So, and pastors do it very well because we know the language. Parishioners who've been Christians a long time, they know how to do it too. We use pious words and pious motives to justify our sinful behavior. And I think that's probably, unless we are the Holy Spirit calls us on that and we repent, it's hard to get out of that.
The Holy Spirit calling us to repent is what a pastor is sent to be and do. But that doesn't mean that just because the Spirit's calling, everyone who hears him is failing to resist. In fact, people often will resist. I think, I mean, you said a lot of interesting things there, but the threat to personal faith, which I hear a little bit as the threat to my justification, which change of any kind creates in the rigid legalist, is kind of at the heart of this, right? So you have, in my experience, a person who knows they need the grace of Jesus Christ more than anything else can handle a lot of change. They can handle things they don't like, you know? But somebody who has made their religion into a an idol, something that they're using to prop up their own ego. If you tinker with like the smallest pebble, now my entire validity as a human is gone. And right. I think that's kind of at the heart of some of this.
Yeah, and I think it's related. Yeah, I think that's true. If it's my church, right, then anything that changes that is a threat to it. And I think it does become an idol. I mean, the best things become the worst idols, right? So that happens with congregations. It happens with faith. It happens with pious Christian language. So I think that's a major aspect to it. And the other thing that you said, I think that is true. If you if you know why we're in the Lord's house on the Lord's day, to receive the Lord's word and the Lord's gifts, then things to the side of that are not going to become as important. But if there's some other reason, other primary reason that people believe that we're there, and I think in America that primary reason is to give something to God, offerings, worship, whatever it is, you know, that's the primary reason I'm there. God is not, the primary reason isn't that God is there to serve me, divine service. The primary reason is for me to serve God. And if that's the case, then if it interferes with me serving God the way I want to serve God, then I get angry about that. Whereas if God is there to give me gifts, and even if it's not the best way, even if it's not in the way that, the music is not what I want it to be, or I don't like that hymn, or it's too slow or too fast or whatever it is, you know, those things I can kind of let slide because, yeah, I know it's not maybe the way I'd like it to be, but it's not going to be perfect in this creation anyway. And so what is happening there, no matter what, Christ is present. He's forgiving me. He is delivering his life to me. I need that no matter what else is happening. And those become contrary ways of viewing what's happening. And so, yeah, I think that's true.
Can you describe your personal experience the first time you realized that one of your members was lying to you? You don't have to go into specifics,
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't expect. I don't think anyone, whether a pastor or a parishioner, goes into a church expecting that Christians, you know, I can't see hearts, so I'm assuming they're all Christians, that Christians are going to be deceptive to get their own ways, that we're going to use the methods of the political world, right, where you assume the worst of your opponents. You assume if you're not with me, you're against me. If you don't agree with me, then there's something wrong with you. You know, those kinds of political things that we see all the time on the internet or political debate or Twitter or whatever. I don't think we assume, maybe we should, I don't know that we assume that that's going to happen among Christians, because we talk a lot about love and grace and mercy and forgiveness, but it just, and frankly, I think those who leave the church, they have a pretty darn good point. If the reason they leave the church is because they believed that it was going to be a place where they're going to find rest and mercy, and instead they find judgment and condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
So frankly, I wouldn't open myself up either, because I know how churches work, right? And I think that's a sad thing, that in churches, that's not a place where people generally are going to come in order to be open and to have people walk alongside them while they're struggling.
It's great. How do we fix that? Because I'm afraid to go to the church I serve. People are pretty good. The congregation I'm at right now, they treat me really well. I don't know how much of this is post-traumatic from previous issues in congregations, how much of it is me just, I learned how the church works. Mm-hmm. So now, how much of them treating me pretty well is that I'm playing the game a little better than I used to, and I know how to move the troops more carefully. How wrong is that of me, right? And then for the parishioner, I mean, if the pastor's afraid to go there, and you want some visitor to come in and come back, right?
Right.
How do we even address this?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably something to gaining some wisdom, right? So some aspects of what you said could just be we get a little bit wiser about what we know we need to do, right? So that's not, I don't think that's entirely bad, but I don't think it's going to happen systematically, like to the system. I don't think the system is ever going to change, because regardless of genuine Christians, there are always going to be those who, I have no idea who they are, but there are always going to be false Christians in the midst of the church.
Yeah, we confess that.
So that in the world, in this world, that's the way it's going to be. Sinners are still sinners. Even redeemed ones, and so even believing ones. So the that's going to kind of always kind of continue on. And so in this world, it's just a struggle against the flesh, right? That we ourselves, and that we try to help people, you're never going to kind of change the system. But that we ourselves learn and practice love and mercy toward others, and that the people who are going to follow us, right? Paul says, imitate me as I imitate Christ. That people who will follow us, the faithful remnant will be there regardless of the destruction that comes because of either unfaithful churches or unfaithful pastors or whatever. I don't know. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah.
As far as
you can't have mercy without vulnerability, and as a pastor, then particularly, you have to be the guy who gets hurt in some respect, right? And that's for me. That I don't want to say I've learned this lesson as if I've fully comprehended it emotionally, but I have learned it intellectually, and that's a shift in the last 3 years for me. That in some ways my job's to be the guy who gets hated, not in necessarily malicious ways, but who takes that hate and returns grace, who remains vulnerable and open even though lemon juice is being poured on the paper cuts. In order that and this is what Christ does for us, right? So that in absorbing the evil and returning good for it, that creates the possibility of vulnerability for the person or the people around you.
I mean, and it's because that's what Jesus does, that that work will extend even though Jesus gets crucified. I mean, I think there's probably, though, I don't know, what do you think about, is there a limit to how vulnerable a pastor should be or how open? Because they're quote, being ourselves or whatever, it's really not what we're supposed to do. I mean, there's that great scene in The Hammer of God where the younger pastor's like, I'm just a regular guy. Mm. And the older pastor's like, you're not, wear the clerical because you're not just a regular guy. So I think there's probably, I don't know, I can't say I know where that line is, but I think there's probably a line where of being too
mm-hmm.
open because and I don't, again, I to pinpoint that, I don't know if I could do it, but I don't think you want to, I think people are expecting certain things from their pastor. And I don't think that I'm not talking about a facade or kind of pretending, pretend holiness. I think we ought to be able to. Somebody said recently, I heard somebody say that the illustrations we use of ourselves in sermons ought to be ones where we are humbled or where we are the bad guy or we made a mistake or we did something rather than, the positive upholding ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I think there's room for that. I just don't know exactly where the line is. You know, people will take stuff. And to some degree, it's going to happen either way, and probably necessary then to be under the cross. But
the bit about, I agree with you that there is a point at which you are a public figure and must live as a public figure, which means not only allowing a certain insight into your life that other people don't have to, but also protecting your life in a way that other people don't have to. And so there is that. I think what you were getting at, though, with The Hammer of God a little more is, I mean, if you don't believe you're in the office, then you can think you're just an ordinary guy. The clerical by itself does not make the office. It's there to show the office.
Sure.
So in some way, shape, or form, this is what Paul says, work out for yourselves whether you're going to have long hair on your women. You got to know what the substance of a thing is, man and woman in that example, and you got to express it somehow in a way that doesn't deny that. And so you don't want to lose the pastor's vulnerability is not there to lose his ability to be the pastor, but neither should he not be a human. And or should he? I remember one of the parishes I was at, I was trying to do some premarital counseling with a couple, and they were really struggling. But she mentioned, the wife mentioned how she would never have gone to the previous pastor with these problems. Mm. And she loved him. She loved him so much and was so afraid of him, she would never have told him she had a problem in her marriage. Well, see, there's a problem there, right? Like, we don't want to create so much fear of judgment that the person can't get care. I don't know if you want to respond to that. I can take us another direction if you want to.
I don't know that I have anything. I mean, what I think one thing I've learned is that whenever there is, I always get nervous when someone's talking about another pastor in critical, because the way that they present it is from their, because frankly I know that there are people saying things about me to other pastors, or if they're talking to me about another pastor, they're going to talk to the next pastor about me.
Yeah,
and I think there's always, it's always more complex than a one. I don't want to ever be too quick to be like, yeah, that was horrible. That guy.
Well, and I didn't say that to her either, right?
Not that you were doing that.
But. I'm more just using that as the example of, I would, if we get to the point where the Christian is afraid of the pastor, we're too far on the other side. We aren't vulnerable enough. But what you just said there, I mean, that, I think I know where that came from a little bit, and I want to push on it a little bit more. Because, again, this gets back to my question, you know, your experience the first time you knew a member was lying to you, and then run that through the first time you realized a member was lying about you. Huh. Yeah.
It's, and sometimes that's hard to, I mean, what could you do about it? I mean, because a lot of times it's anonymous, right? Or
people are saying.
Yeah, or it's in a secret or a private conversation where sometimes it's hard to, you know, I just try to let it go. If it's some private conversation and I hear about it secondhand, yeah, whatever. But, I don't know what causes people. Part of it is I think that some people form narratives of their experience and then they fit everything. I mean, we all to a degree do this, but sometimes people have such tightly woven narratives that anything that would go against what they already believe can't fit in it. It doesn't. For some people, you have a narrative and think alternate information or things change what you think about something. For other people, it can't change, and so it fits in somehow or another. I think that's, at least for some people, that's probably what happens in those kind of situations, that I don't think they're thinking, I'm going to say something untrue about my past or about someone else. Maybe sometimes they are. But I think most of the time, they interpret something and then they assume, based on that interpretation, what somebody's doing or saying. And so, or they hear some side information and then they say, well, that must have gotten to that person via this, and they assume it and then they say it out loud. I mean, this has happened to me a couple times where two different people will come in and talk to me about something, and they will talk about this, like they had some sort of either conflict or conversation, and they will tell me the account of the situation, and they will say diametrically opposed things. Mm-hmm. Like they're contradictory. They couldn't both have happened. And yet I don't know, because I wasn't there, and I don't think like one of them is a liar and one of them's not. I don't know what the reality is, but it's amazing to me that they can both say, describe the same conversation or experience in a contradictory terms. Mm. So I don't know exactly how that happens. That's something I have no idea, but
human memory.
Yeah.
And our interpretation of what we see, is not as strong as we think. And everyone thinks, you know, I lived through last week. I know exactly what happened. I don't know. Is that a human problem, sin problem, American problem? We don't have near the recollection power that we think we do. It's where all this stuff about Kavanaugh. I mean, we don't have to go into politics, but that it was just, you know, 35-year-old memories, right?
I can't remember 3 weeks ago.
I know. In theory, it was a traumatic event, but we can't remember as nearly as well as we think we can.
I'm not responding to that because I don't want to.
Yeah. Politics is... I haven't done politics yet as a podcast.
I think about that a lot because more and more I question... I say, I think this is how I remember it.
Right.
But I doubt my memory all the time now. And
how you intended to be perceived versus how you're actually perceived. Truth is probably somewhere in the middle of those things. You mentioned earlier, you said the system is never going to change. And I kind of have two questions. One is, what's the system?
I'm mainly thinking of like institutions where institute, you know, and in terms of the church, you have the institution, the buildings, the money, the external goods or the functioning of it. And then you have the church, and those are overlapping, mm-hmm. but they're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this world, now institutions might come and go, but in terms of the way human sinners function day to day, seems to me in this creation at least, that overarching thing isn't going to change. Whereas people can be converted. I don't know that you can convert an institution.
So because the system is part of a fallen creation, it's always going to have a fallenness to it. Does that mean that there are not better systems, or that we shouldn't strive for better systems?
I think that the more people are realistic, so you think of like communism. I mean, I don't know that anybody would say the idea that we all share things in common, we do what's best for each other, and we don't take more for me and so that there's less for you or whatever the assumptions are. I don't think anybody, you know, you read Acts 2 or you read Acts 4 and that, you know, Acts 5, they're doing that. But you see even in the book of Acts that sin enters in and you have people who say, I didn't get as much as they got, or I'm going to tell you I'm going to give you this much, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lying to, not to Peter, but to God. You know, so the idea of, so I think it's more a matter of being realistic about human sinners, the fact that we're going to keep sinning, and that it'd be great if we were completely sanctified and our sin was gone. Then there would be a possibility. You know, like Luther says, if we insofar as we are Christians, we don't need the law. We don't need civil laws because we will do what is good and loving for our neighbor. But the sinful flesh doesn't want to. It wants to do what's good for me. And so I think if we're realistic about sinners and we're realistic about the way that gets worked out within institutions, then we can repent. We can confess our sins. But that's how. I don't like to think about it in terms of impersonal institutions, because I don't think they repent, right? People repent.
Yeah, well, institutions can't repent.
Yeah. So the only way I think you get better workings within an institution or a system is people are realistic. They confess. They forgive. They show mercy and love. But I guess it's a, you know, it's beyond my ability to sort of say which systems might be kind of broken inherently, where they can't get better. I don't know. I don't know that I don't have enough to be able to say, you know, that there are some, or what it would look like, or those kinds of things. But I think generally speaking, like, you know, when we talk about problems in the world, or we talk about sin in the world, and we say, well, how come it's so bad, and how do we fix that, and how do we fix... I think the only thing you can do is, me and my family, we start doing what God wants us to do, loving our neighbor in the family. Because, you know, Adam and Eve, first human community, and then everything goes out from there. So if I see problems in families, the thing to do is not to say how bad things are in the families. I mean, we can point that out, but the thing to do is say, I better look at my own family. And you know, Paul says this, it's time for judgment to begin with the house of God. So if we see problems in the church, or we see problems in the world, I think families focus on what God is calling them to do, is serve each other. Local congregations focus on what God is called. And then I think that trickles up. I don't know how to say that. It goes beyond that, the local
So you're officially a proponent of trickle up ecclesiology.
Yep.
So, so being realistic, I really like this phrase because I think it's that's the American version of loving good order, at least the way you're using it. Because you mean two things, I think, right? You mean being realistic about expectations, not expecting things that can't be. Mm. But I think you also mean looking at what's been done and honestly assessing it realistically. Did it work? Did it not work? Should we keep doing it? At least that's what I want you to have it mean. Because then that's then how it gets to, you know, you said, I don't know that I know or have the information to say this will work, this won't work. But we do at this point, is my opinion, we do at this point in history as church have a great deal of information about what works and what does not work to organize congregations.
Yeah.
And yet we ignore a lot of it, I think. And this gets back to what I've set up to make myself comfortable with. Within the Missouri Synod, we have a certain pattern that we've been doing for only really 30 years, actually, for most of our congregations officially. But where people, their memories are short. They think it's, you know, that the Synod was founded with voters' assemblies and the Lutheran Reformation came out with the constitutions we have now.
Yeah.
I have real questions about that. I think we can – I don't think it's unrealistic or just my opinion to say – we've put in place a very dysfunctional system at the moment, particularly for the expectation of being nonprofit organizations in a marketplace context where we are. There's a lot there. But I want to kind of push it back toward you a little bit with that as context for the question. With what you have experienced right now as a pastor in the Missouri Synod, if you're in trouble, where do you go? Is there help? I think the average layperson assumes we have these things called districts and they're there and they'll be helpful. I think the average pastor assumes we have these things called districts and I want them to stay as far away from me as possible. Mm-hmm. You have an open piece of paper to say whatever you want in response to that. You don't have to even answer it, but.
Well, if it's all right, before I say something about that I think what you said about expectations, that's the other aspect of things that I think for most of us, most of the time, we experience our own expectations as sort of realistic and you know, not too far reaching. And why can't those expectations be met? But then when it comes to conflicting expectations or expectations based on other people or other things, So pastors and churches have expectations when a pastor comes there. And what are those based on? Well, they're based on my past, but then they're based on the information I get from either in call documents or in, you know, the pastoral information or whatever it is, what people know about this pastor or this congregation. And I think expectations, that might be one of the most damaging things that happens is that expectations run and not asking what is the simple reality of these people.
Mm-hmm.
I think for at least most pastors I know, our expectations get tempered pretty quickly. You know, well, and or we learn not to come in with too many expectations. We have the call documents, but who knows who put those together? How widely spread is the sort of outlook that's in the call documents, those kinds of things. I think pastors tend to know, look, I don't really know anything about this place yet. So whatever's there in the call documents, I can't assume anything, or at least we learn that eventually. But I don't know. I wonder if expectations on the part of congregations get tempered. Some people, I think it does. You know, I've had people tell me in my congregation that looking at my information, they said I didn't vote for you. Now, okay, it becomes a unanimous vote at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
But those expectations changed when we actually met and we talked and they heard what I had to say and those kinds of things, positively. you know, reverse that
yeah.
supportive, right? So
yeah.
after, so I think for some people it does, but if expectations are so hardened, either on the part of the pastor or the people, that I need to fit this church or this pastor into my expectations, and if not, get rid and find another one, get another call, get another pastor. I think when expectations get hardened into an unwillingness to modify based on the actual people, then that's one of the most damaging things. And maybe that happens in the Synod as well, or the district. But on that point, I think it's maybe more so about, again, institutions. I mean, I think this is the problem generally in institutional churches, is that you have to protect the institution.
Mm-hmm.
When that becomes the thing, rather than saying, I like this institution, but if it goes away, I'm not going to shed too many tears, because what's important is the gifts of Christ and what he is doing, and he can do that without this building and without this place, right? He can do it without the synod. He can do it without this district. None of that is necessary to the work of the Lord. But when we think that it is, that's what we were talking about. It becomes an idol where at all costs, any threat to our beloved synod becomes a threat that has to be crushed.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that happens, and I think that maybe not to that extent, but sometimes it becomes at least the perceived reality, and that might be why pastors don't approach bureaucrats, and I'm not saying that completely negatively, although you know, but
administrators,
but yeah, that's why we don't, because we believe. And rightly or wrongly in every case or whatever, but we believe that they're going to act first to protect the institution.
Which means congregations matter, which means that the congregation wins, because the congregation pays the money to the district and the pastor doesn't.
Yeah.
And so the pastor is always exactly. at a realistically systemic disadvantage, regardless of the situation.
That probably sounds fairly cynical to an average member of a congregation, but think about how worried congregations get when money
mm-hmm.
is limited. Well, how are we going to keep the doors open? How are we going to keep the lights on? What are we going to do about this? And so we start worrying about the money. I mean, when does the Lord need our gifts in order to do his work? If the Lord wants to multiply dollar bills, like he multiplied bread and fish, he can do that to do his work. We as soon as we're worried about money or the institution or the building, and I say this to people, I say, you need to consider that if we didn't have this building, if we didn't have the funds, if we didn't have the food bank or these things that we do, these groups that meet here, all these, whatever it is that a church has, program-wise or building-wise or whatever. If we didn't have all this stuff, would we still be able to do the church stuff? And if all of that stuff goes away and we're like, I don't know what to do now, we're in a bad place. But if we can say, yep, all this building, all the money, everything can go away, we just need some bread and some wine and the mm-hmm. scriptures,
mm-hmm.
Then we at least are being realistic about what the church is. And then we can go forward with what we have, for now, at least, do it, being as faithful as we can with what we've been given. But if it goes away, you know, the state decides to tax churches and church buildings and property goes away, we better be able to still do the church. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we're worse off than we think.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Worse off than we think. It's a happy accident of history that we call the words Jesus spoke over bread and wine the words of institution. But I think it has a lot to say about this conversation. Well, and speaking then of institutions and structure and order and business and expectations, you're a happily married man.
Yes.
Four kids now?
Yep.
Four kids. I want to talk about fatherhood just for a few moments. How old's your oldest?
14.
14. My oldest is 14.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jonas is your oldest? No.
Lucia.
Lucia. Oh, right. I knew Lucia. Okay. Jonas. Oldest boy then is Jonas. And how old is he?
He's 12.
What do you guys do for school? Public, private, home?
The two older ones go to public schools and the two younger ones go to the Lutheran school.
Okay. So why the difference? Is it high school, grade school
thing? Yeah, pretty well. So the Lutheran school goes to, I think, sixth grade.
Okay.
But the middle schools in East Wenatchee, they start at fifth grade. So our idea was, well, if everybody else from all these other schools is coming in at the same time, that the transition might not be as rough coming into
right.
that school if everybody else is kind of new. So,
right.
So that was our thought, and sometimes it works and sometimes.
So we did public school for a year in North Dakota. I wasn't a fan. And it was a decent public school. I mean, it wasn't doing the gender stuff yet. what's your experience with this as a parent? And maybe more importantly, what are you doing to make sure that they are not just getting Americanized?
I mean, so we haven't had like the schools that my two older kids go to, they haven't been like they haven't come home saying they said this in the health class or I think there are, it's Eastern Washington, a lot of Christians around of some kind or another. So I think they're generally, for the most part, I mean, it's probably, if it's not there yet, it's going to come. But so far, that part of it hasn't been the threat. You know, it hasn't really been like they're teaching this or they're teaching that, or they're telling these people that they better say these things or not say those things. I would say it's more so just with the damage to families in the United States, so that the kids who are in school with them come from places that they're in trouble. I mean, the kids are they know things and they say things and they've seen things that I don't want my kids to have to deal with. They're going to have to deal with them, but I want to prepare them before they kind of get to that point.
So how are you doing that?
Both of my older kids, like they're very thoughtful about situations or conversations that they have with people, with friends, and we talk a lot about that. So they'll come home and they'll say, my friend's saying this, and we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. And I'm not claiming to be the best at sort of being like, huh, let's think about that together. I'm usually like, no, you're not talking that way. They read a lot, and we try to emphasize and kind of steer. My 14-year-old, she'll pick all sorts of books up, and I'm like, yeah, today we're not going to read this one. You know, maybe down the line. My daughter read, I forget what the book is called, Mona Sharon. Something about, it has sex prominently in the title,
no.
I saw the title, I was like, you're not reading that. What are you talking about? She's a Christian who's writing about the world and the way that, the world views male and female and sexuality and those kinds of things. So she did read it. She reads World Magazine. She reads, you know, and so we talk about the things that are there, and my son is very, very sensitive to the way people act, like the way boys that he knows act toward girls.
Mm.
Very sensitive to that, and he knows it's there.
So what is that? I mean, there's all this. You would think from listening to the media that we're really winning the war against toxic masculinity by fighting so hard to keep these boys. It's not like getting worse, right? Why is that, do you think? Like the more we reject masculinity, the more bestial the men become.
I think it's because we haven't recognized the root of the problem yet. So we see the symptoms. I mean, rape, assault, you know, the things that happen in Hollywood or politics or in schools or on college campuses, we see the results of, and we say, these are bad things. We need to stop these things. The problem is they still know the people who are thinking about and who have the kind of public responsibility or are tasked with doing something about it, don't see the root of the problem. There's a documentary about it started as a documentary about spring break. These people just slipped my mind.
That's all right.
It started as a documentary about spring break, and the people who make it, I think they're Christians, but it turned into a documentary about the way men act. So it plays well into the current narrative. And I don't think even that documentary gets at the root of the problem, which is when you destroy families, when you say it's bad as a husband to protect your wife, you're equal. I mean, you're the same.
Right.
Equal, of course. But that you're the same and you're interchangeable. And when you say, and the main thing that came to me out of that documentary was that you listen to the girls talk. They interview a bunch of women who are at spring break. Like, why are you there? Because they asked this one girl, do you feel safe here? She's like, no, safe? But she's still there. And I think it has to do with the pressure that the culture says men act like this toward women. And if you want to be strong and empowered, you better act the same way. Hmm. So you have sex with as many people as you want because that's what guys do, right? So this, one, a false view of what men, well, what they should do at least, and then transfer that to women, and then everybody, it'll make it all better if we empower. But it's just the continual sort of fallout from sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And now we say it's there's kind of a second, the movie kind of says there's a second sexual revolution, but I see it simply as what proceeds from the, so now you, instead of saying it's all about love and we love, you can love as many people as you want and all that kind of thing. And now the kids in this movie, they say, you know, love is a fake thing. Love is something that you say to someone in order to get them into bed. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's gone another step. And so this is my long way of saying, I don't think that anybody has recognized that the root of the problem is actually about marriage and the family. They're only trying to address the symptoms and not the root. Because they can't address the root of it.
No. And then that brings us, at least in my mind, back to, I think, the segregation of procreation from sex as substantial. That it, not that you can't have a marriage with two people who are infertile. It's possible, it's still marriage. But that we would think that that's the way God made it, mm-hmm. right? Or that they have the fullness of what God designed. That divorce, pun intended, is at the root of a lot of this. I'm going to shift directions again here. Good stuff, Tim. Really enjoying this. I want to do some quick hit questions.
I'll try.
Yeah, you'll like some of these. They'll be up your alley. And you can do 2 to 3 sentences. We may go further on one. We may not. It just kind of depends. But how do you measure success at the end of your day?
quick hit. I don't know if I've gotten there. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, obviously in terms intellectually, mm-hmm. I know that have – vocation is for me so primary. So have I done the best that I can to serve my congregation in love and serve my wife and children? And if I haven't, I'm going to confess and get forgiveness. So I think you got to deal with the people who have been given to you right here and now to serve. And that's about all you can do as far as this world and success, I think.
Okay.
Scriptural.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I want to follow up, but I'm not going to. What is something you believe that most Lutherans don't believe?
Let's see. What do I believe? I don't know. I don't. I mean, most Lutherans in the world.
I don't know. Your sheer experience.
I think...
I could say it this way. Where are Lutherans wrong?
I think the primary thing I see in the American church is this, is instead of saying, here's what Lutherans believe and confess, they say, Lutherans believe and confess this because it's against...
Hmm.
And then maybe this is built into our DNA, protestant.
Yeah.
But I find it very frustrating that when we say, well, we dismiss something by saying that's mainly Roman Catholic.
You know, right.
That's Catholic. Well, so then we're defining ourselves in terms of what we're not. And I think that's a bad way to go.
So I like this. So that you see perhaps in our DNA that we define ourselves in antithesis rather than in thesis,
right.
Which is probably true. That's good. What book have you reread the most and you can't say the Bible or the Confessions? Doesn't have to be theology.
Probably something by Flannery O'Connor. I don't know. Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah. Let me flip it then. What movie have you rewatched the most?
That one's easier. Probably The Apostle.
Oh, really?
I watched that because of your
recommendation. I probably was too mature as a theologian to appreciate it when I watched it.
The other would be The Godfather.
Okay.
Yeah. I love The Godfather.
It's a good movie. I don't know if I could rewatch it much, though.
As much as some of the acting in Part 3 bothers me, I even like Part 3 because I think it brings the story all the way around.
What's your favorite mafia movie that's not The Godfather series?
Well, Sons of Anarchy fit in there.
Yeah, that works. Actually, I mean, it's out of left field, but yeah, it's definitely organized crime.
Have that kind of feeling to them.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, we could do a whole series on that because I know we both enjoyed that, but
sometimes it was like train.
Yeah, and I came out of it really disappointed. I know you really liked the closing.
No, I didn't. I didn't like the end.
Oh, I thought you did.
No. I was totally with you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think I don't know if we talked about this particular, but the ending to me was. I think they should have stopped an episode earlier.
Yeah.
I think.
Probably. They should have stopped after season two.
Yeah. So I agree with you that. No, I'm with you.
Oh, goodness. Who's your favorite fictional antagonist?
I don't know. Antagonist. Well, since I said Flannery O'Connor, I think there's a guy who ends up being kind of the devil in one of her stories, but he's a very, you know, subtle kind of creepy, and he sucks in the other characters, and I'm not going to be able to remember the guy's name or right off the top of my head the story, but she does that well. She has people who. If you met I would say the misfit. I'd say the misfit. I'll go with the misfit from A Good Man Is Hard to Find. It's a violent story.
Okay.
He gets this car to crash and it's got a family and the grandmother and he kills him and he says of the grandmother, she'd have been a good woman if there had been someone there to kill her every day of her life.
Oh wow.
Jeez. And just the idea of and there's also a thing in there that he says about Jesus, but Misfit, yeah, he's good.
I'm not sure I can follow you on
read,
this.
Read the whole story.
What's the book's called? The Misfit?
No, it's a short story.
It's a short story.
It's called A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
Is that Flannery O'Connor?
Yeah.
Okay. Where do you find her short stories? Like,
there's a book called Collected Stories. That has all her.
So if someone's interested in Flannery O'Connor, that's where they should start.
That's where I would
collect the stories. Okay.
My and favorite story is The River, but that I antagonist wise, The Misfit.
The Misfit. Yeah. Cool. Underappreciated writer in American Christian circles. She's a Christian, but doesn't really write as propaganda.
I mean, in her letters and essays, she makes the point of that about art, that she simply is who she is. And she writes, she's a Roman Catholic, or she was, and she writes from that rather than saying, I want to make a point about Roman Catholicism or about Christianity. She just writes stories where people are, you know, she's probably a little, you know, when people think of Christian writers, they're probably like G.K. Chesterton, Flannery O'Connor, C.S. Lewis, you know, that's kind of probably, but I think her stories deserve more than more attention than.
Yeah. Short stories are tough sells as part of the issue there. What's the best tool you've purchased for under $100 in the last 5 years?
You're assuming I purchased a tool.
It doesn't have to be like a screwdriver. Something you use. The thing you, what's your best purchase under $100 in the last 5 years?
Typewriter.
A real one?
Yeah. I have five.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Where do you keep five? Do you have five desks?
No, I have one's in my study.
Uh-huh.
It's a big, heavy one that I don't move around. It just stays there. I have another desk that I have. Well, the three portable ones are at that desk, and then I have I found a big electric one from 1951.
What's the interest in typewriters? That's fascinating.
It's a documentary again that I saw that I wrote about it on the Jagged Word recently. That's called California Typewriter. My brother says to me, you got to see this movie about typewriters. I said, I don't want to see a movie about typewriters. That's going to be the most boring thing I've ever seen. Then I watched the movie. I mean, this is an excellent documentary.
You know the title of it?
California Typewriter.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah.
And so I was just intrigued. So I just went to some thrift stores and I found some relatively cheap typewriters, and just there's, again, I'm so bound to my technology that's gonna, I would never like go completely analog, but there's something, you're not distracted, right? If you write anything, if you write letters, if you write stories, if you write poems, if you write music or whatever, a typewriter will keep you. There's no windows. There's nothing popping up.
You can't back up.
You know? And
that's the part that get me.
But that's also a part of the benefit, I think, where you can write, just write, and then you can edit it. I mean, they interview like David McCullough, the historian, and Sam Shepard. They still write everything on typewriters. They don't even use computers for. Now, I don't know how it gets actually somehow it gets copied.
When you're good enough, they'll go ahead and do it for you, right?
But so they do it because they want to see it all there. And David McCullough historian mentions that you know, speeches by politicians in the past, you could see, if you had the chance, you could see what they had taken out, how they had edited as a historical document.
Yeah.
That's valuable. And he says that's not going to exist.
Because, we're not going to have letters either. It's right. Kind of the thing.
So Ryan Tinetti and I have been writing letter. We've corresponded via typewritten letter.
Huh. That's a really cool thing. Oh, I there was another question that came in there that I've lost now, but that, man, that's really interesting, Tim. What's the first 60 minutes of your day look like? What's the pattern? Your habit you go through? It's like the things are the same every day.
Yeah.
What is it?
Hit the snooze button.
Yes.
And until the last moment. Then I got it. I went, see, and this is something that I dislike at the moment. And I wish I had sort of the energy and the ability and the fortitude to do homeschool, because people I know, like I get up. I wake up my older kids, take a shower, take them to school, wake up my younger kids, feed them breakfast, make their lunch, make coffee, and take them to school. And so that's the first hour and a half, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we have matins at the church at 8:30
when I get
back. But that hurried, and, you know, I have friends who homeschool, and they sit around the table as a family, and they eat breakfast, and
it's always a little different every morning. We had our kids play. Our oldest three were allowed to join the volleyball team for the local Lutheran school, even as homeschool kids, which was great. It was crazy how much that dynamic changed our world. And it wasn't about the volleyball. It was about getting to the school. Mm. that just put such a pressure on us for 3 months. I would have loved to have them play basketball too, but we're like, we need a break from that. How do people do this?
I don't know. I mean, so my son plays football and lacrosse, and the football's not bad. It's all local, and it's only on Saturday mornings and stuff. Mm. Lacrosse though, they're and he doesn't like he's not on traveling like they don't. It's not all year. It's not so we don't. He's not doing that kind of thing, but. Still, they have, you know, 5 or 6 tournaments in the year, and they're Saturday, Sunday. And, you know, so he missed the first game last year when it was local because I was like, no, you got to come. And the coach is fine. He understands. Mm. But that's something that I think that frustrates me to no end that families think that for whatever reason we can – most of the time not go to church and then later somehow my kids will somehow come be Christians. If it's not, I mean, even if your kid was going to make it to pro whatever, which very, very likely not, but even if they were, if you don't set that priority thing at the beginning, when they're 13, 16, 18, you think that that's going to be a priority for them then?
It's right. He does flip it too. Like, and you mentioned the coach is okay with him missing a game. Like, you think your kid's going to not go to practice, going to not participate, and then suddenly show up and be good at sports, but you want to take that approach to church? I mean, you're crazy. Yeah. You're crazy.
Because church is spiritual. And so it's unlike it's like unlike everything else.
I'm gonna call them on it. They don't think it's real, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, there's this. You're right by calling it this the spirituality. There's nothing really disciplined about spirituality. It's just sort of how I feel or what I want to think. Very limp wristed.
So when we teach the catechism, we think that should be taught differently from how we teach everything else, and it doesn't work. Mm-mm. It doesn't work. Because our brains are still our brains, whether we're learning scriptures or we're learning math, and so it's simply a false. But this is what we, you know, speaking of what we've done and whether it works or not. This is what we've tried to do for the last 40 years, and you know, okay, so now 40 years later, we're seeing the fruit where those kids and their kids are not in church at all, and so now. It we talked about this on Boars in the Vineyard. It baffles me to no end that people think that what we've done for 40 years, we just need to do more of that to get them to come back.
Right.
As if 40 years experience of our own experience, we don't have to do a study. You can see the gap of generation. There's no studies that need to be done. You can just say, look, this hasn't worked. And so you want to do more in order to, they're not coming back that way.
No. New question. What dusty corner of theology are you currently obsessed with?
I wish I had more. I every time I go into my study, I see the 2-volume selected works of Johannes Bugenhagen, and I really want to open those and look at them.
Yeah, that's good.
That's not really obsessed. I don't
know. No. And we talked, I forgot, we kind of talked about, or you mentioned this, like losing your imagination when it comes to studying theology. And I've had the same experience. And the question I've been asking about, part of the question is, you know, how do I rekindle that?
Yeah. The typewriters have gotten me thinking about along these lines of like, especially on my, on Mondays is my day off. And if I would do what I needed to do, get up early enough, and I would have essentially the whole day to sort of, you know, work on things that are not directly related to my main vocation. I don't necessarily do it.
You know. The last thing I'm going to do on my day off is work, which is what theology is. That's kind of the problem I'm in, right? Because then it's anyway.
But you can work on what you, so for me, like when I, after I finished my MDiv and I did my STM, I could focus on what I wanted to focus on. It was work, but it was joy-filled work because I was like, this excites me to study this, to find the answers to these questions, to do these things. And that's it's been a while since that's been the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Me
still
too.
Still happens sometimes with sermons. Still happens sometimes with Bible studies, but not nearly
as tough. The grind makes it really tough. If you could lead a 2-week boot camp for young men, the summer before they go to college, what would it look like?
It's interesting. One, we talk a lot about vocation and what it means in this particular time and place. And I think that would involve, you know, talking then about the pressures talking about the pressures that I probably have them watch this documentary and I
on typewriters.
No, the other one, which I can't remember the name of right now.
I'm going to call him out. Okay. So hold on. I'm interviewing Tim and it's a really good conversation. And this guy named Larry Yaw, who is a pastor in the Missouri Synod, is outside of a window trying to distract Tim right now. He doesn't know what we're doing. He's a punk. He's a complete punk. Yeah. So, what's the documentary you're referring to?
On something. This is my problem when I come
up and think of something. It's Larry's fault.
And maybe there's a book called I Am Charlotte Simmons by this is what I would love to do just in general is have infinite jest, amusing ourselves to death, and Idiocracy. And Out of the Ashes by Anthony Esselin, have those be as a series of just thinking about the world. And I think that those kinds of things, I'm Charlotte Simmons by Tom Wolfe, about this girl who thinks she's going to college to be intellectually stimulated, and she's going to be with like-minded people who all want to learn and to study and to have grow in wisdom, and she finds out it's not at all like that, and by the end of the book she's completely lost her identity. So the book is called I Am Charlotte Simmons. By the end of the book I think it's maybe even the last line says something like calls her this guy's boyfriend.
Girlfriend. Yeah
And her name's not there anymore. And I think that just any number of things around that idea of and I don't know, today's university, I'm not sure, I might say encourage him to go to some other, you know, trade school.
The question comes from the idea of actually doing this maybe at some point, but then actually wanting it to be a 1 year between college, which then would replace college. But that's another thing. Who's Infinite Jest by?
David Foster Wallace.
David Foster Wallace. And then Neil Postman is Amusing Ourselves to Death. Yeah. What was the fourth one you said?
Anthony Esselin.
I don't know that one.
It's just a devastating diagnosis of where we are in the culture.
Okay.
And he basically says, it's not coming back. Yeah. We got to start over.
Yeah.
And so some people, you know, there's a lot of debate out there about that, along with the Benedict Option by Rod Dreher. And maybe it's just because I naturally tend to the cynical, but I really think he hits exact. I think he's clear-eyed, unlike a lot of people. A lot of people still have some optimism about late 21st century America. I don't have too much. So,
love to get you and Adam Kuntz together. I don't know if you know his name. Oh. He's a Missouri Synod pastor, and he's not quite Amish, but it's almost like, that's what we should do, kind of thing. He's very inspiring to me when I hear him talk. You got a favorite Bible verse?
In Romans 8, talking about the whole creation groaning and waiting for the redemption of our bodies.
That's good. That's good. Do you have a favorite non-Bible quote?
Probably, but I don't know if I can think of one right now. I used to kind of collect quotations. I can't think of off the top of my head, though.
So okay, that's obviously fine. two more. What major idea have you changed your mind about in the last couple of years?
Oh man, another good question. It's sort of been, I feel like it's been progressing a little bit, but I used to care about politics to some degree or another. And but that might be simply a symptom of my general lethargy with caring about things outside of what's going on at the moment.
In the present, but, yeah.
But I think it is that when people take something that is less than ultimate too seriously, that puts me off. Mm-hmm. And if it's in its proper place, sports, politics, I don't know, Christmas songs on the radio. if it's in its proper place, I'm all for it. I'm all for, you know, whatever kind of enjoyment or happiness comes from that. But when it becomes the ultimate thing and when you take it too seriously, it ruins it for mm-hmm. me.
Like, yeah.
I want NFL on Sunday afternoon to be a distraction and to be relaxing and just fun. And I can pretend to care about it a lot.
Yeah.
I can yell at the players or, you know, get mad about the losing or whatever. And I can pretend, but the next day, you know, I don't care that much.
Right.
And that's, I think, how it should be. Same thing with politics. I think we should pretend, sort of, that it's important, that we need to do it in terms of, well, I want this guy to win and I'm going to vote for them and here's why and all that kind of stuff. But when it takes it too seriously and the other people are your enemies and you can't even talk to them and you hate them and you want them to die or go away, I mean, you've lost the point. I'm not interested in participating in that at all.
Yeah.
So I think it's just in general that sort of shift for me in terms of what I care about. And I'm not saying that's completely good.
No, it's a good answer, though. What is the most important first article truth you see most people ignoring? I mean, you already talked about family. You can go there again if you want, but
The importance of the body.
Oh, interesting.
And the denial of the resurrection, even if it's implicit, like, you know, dying and going to heaven, that's the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you can basically ignore the entire first article.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have ever heard. I haven't heard too many people, at least I don't remember it growing up, ever talking about the new creation. It's so fundamental to the scriptures and to what Christ is doing, and yet totally truncate it and talk about dying and my soul going to heaven. It's just not even, that's not even Christian.
Now I lay me down to sleep. Yeah. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Yeah. No, so
and say, we talk about it, this many souls in worship or saving souls or, mm-hmm. and I that. It may be in a previous generation that encompassed the physical to some degree.
Mm.
I think it could have. I think now, though, when people hear that, that's the only thing they think about is not your body. It's your
right.
whatever animates your body. And I think that's bad for not only for our hope, but I think it's bad for how we live in this world.
Yeah.
So I would say the body in general, implying everything physical that we live in.
Says the guy with tattoos. Are your tattoos going to be on you in the resurrection?
I don't know. I've thought about that sometimes.
Yeah? If you like them, they stay. If you don't like them, they're gone.
No, I think... I don't know. Sometimes I want to say I think yes, because what we do with our bodies matters.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I want to say, if God decides to I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I'm with you.
I think about it though.
It's fun to think about. What it pushes me to right away is that our Lord is carrying his scars for eternity.
Right. Yeah, right.
Doesn't mean we're going to have scars, but there's something important about it. And then I've thought about, so my tattoo, I don't know if you ever saw it, some cheap dragons on my shoulder. And it looks more and more like an old man tattoo these days too. It's not in the best shape. I don't really like it in the sense that I wouldn't put it on my body now. I like dragons still. I like fantasy stuff. So part of me is like, well, paradise would be like I'd be washed clean of decisions that I... And it was from a time that wasn't a great time in my life. But then part of me is like, no, like that's the reminder of what I'm safe from. Why wouldn't I want that for all eternity to tell me what I am no longer? I don't know. It's kind of a silly thing.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting... But, you know, again, I believe it 100% that what we do with our bodies matters because these bodies are going to be raised. What that will mean in terms of, you know, our age, body shape, things we've done,
yeah.
You know, diseases or injuries, I think that, like, say, you know, quadriplegics.
Right, right.
I believe that's going to be healed in the resurrection.
Yeah.
So it's obviously going to be a mitigated sort of, and whatever we say is going to be sort of mitigated by the fact that it's going to be a healing and a wholeness in the resurrection. So, I mean, what age will it be? I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe it will be the age before we got tattoos. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. They're all 17, so it was illegal. But if you were in a culture where they did it before 17, you still got them. Pastor Timothy Winterstein, pastor at Faith Lutheran Church in East Wenatchee. Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Washington. Again, you can find more of his stuff, The Jagged Word. Yeah, he writes on the movies every Friday. I mean, I want to just do a whole thing with movies on you now. With you on movies now. And then Boars in the Vineyard podcast. Maybe this will get you doing a few more of those more regularly. Podcasting, it's a wild west right now. It's the time to start. Yeah. And you've been doing it for a long time. So thank you for being
thank you.
My
appreciate
guest.
It. It's good.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? Project Resurrection is made possible by listeners like you and your patronage of my husband's work. Click the Patreon link in the show notes to sign up. Pretty please?